What's up, dogs? So, Philip Goff has converted to Christianity, sort of, and some of you have asked my thoughts about this. He just came out on Capturing Christianity's channel and sat down for like an hour and a half talking about his new Christian faith. And it's a little confusing because I know that he was already a fictionalist. That was actually the first conversation that he and I had on the podcast, was about how he's already a practicing Christian, even though he couldn't believe in some of the doctrines. So he was already going to church, as far as I know. He was already calling himself a Christian, but now he's accepted a few more of the traditional doctrines. But like I said, it's kind of confusing because the whole premise of that episode was like, this is no different than being a secular Jew. Like, you can be a secular Christian, you're still a Christian. There's, of course, still a distinction between Christians who are fictionalists, just as there is a distinction between secular Jews and Jews who really believe in it. But there are non-doxastic elements of religion that you can still practice and adhere to. In a sense, it would be weird to not call you a Christian if you sort of did all of the things that Christians do, but then just didn't affirm, like, the bodily resurrection or something. But anyway, now he's just now a Christian, according to the interview. Why this famous atheist became a progressive Christian. You gotta throw that in there. Because he has a very non-standard form of Christianity. He labels it heretical Christianity, which is just to signal that he still doesn't really buy into most of the things that Christians would want him to buy into, which is why a lot of Christians are underwhelmed by his quote-unquote conversion. And, you know, I'm kind of two minds about this. So just to go through what he actually believes. He believes in a limited God, so a finite God, just something we've discussed on this podcast before, kind of helps with the problem of evil. He seems to accept something like panentheism, which is roughly the idea that the universe is a part of God, like God and the universe are sort of overlapping. So one way of thinking about this, not necessarily the way Goff does, but one way of thinking about it is that we are in the mind of God. So it's sort of a form of idealism, if you think about it that way. So he accepts something like panentheism, a finite, limited God. He rejects the virgin birth. He thinks the Bible is filled with errors and mistakes. He rejects penal substitution for the atonement. He does not believe in the bodily resurrection. And it seems like he rejects a lot of the miracles, like water into wine, multiplying loaves and fishes, and that kind of thing. And he thinks the resurrection was basically just like a visionary experience. So along with Dale Allison, he kind of collapses the ascension, where Jesus floats up into the sky, where heaven is, and the resurrection. And he just says, actually, those are the same event. So Jesus kind of transformed into a, you know, pure energy being or something, which is technically still physical. He just kind of vaporized in the tomb, and the disciples had experiences of him, and they felt him, but it wasn't the same as, like, looking at an ordinary body. And he thinks the stories where Jesus is eating, and people are, like, touching his hand holes or whatever, he thinks those were later additions by the Gnostics, or no, to fight against the Gnostics. So it's kind of strange because he sounds a lot like an atheist or an agnostic when he's talking about developments in the text and how these things are added or taken away to win whatever theological argument some of those people in that time and place were having. You know, it's like a very human view of the Bible where people are making additions and subtractions and altering things to kind of fit their theological agenda, which they think they're doing the right thing. They think they're doing God's work. They're not, like, being deceptive and manipulative. But there's a very good case to be made that a lot of the things that are in the Bible were not in the earliest manuscripts. You know, these were not things that the earliest Christians were talking about or believed. So it's not just that the Bible has errors and mistakes, but, like, there's development in the text. Which, you know, I mean, not only does Bart Ehrman believe that, but so do Christians like Dale Allison. Because it's just a rational view of the text. The earliest Christians probably believed things that were, you know, quite different from the Christians in the year 1200 or 2000. But, you know, denying some of the miracles of Jesus, that's a little... that seems to take it a little far, no? It's another thought on the resurrection. Goff seems motivated, at least in part, by the thought that Jesus' resurrection and appearances need to be squared with divine hiddenness. You know, why are there non-resistant non-believers? So his version of the resurrection, it sounds less like a divine intervention and less overtly miraculous. And it sounds like his thinking is something along the lines of, well, if Jesus could appear and reveal himself to everyone, then why wouldn't he do that? He must not be able to. So Philip takes divine hiddenness seriously, and he's trying to balance the resurrection with evil and hiddenness. Well, maybe God's finite nature can square with hiddenness and suffering in the resurrection if we interpret it as Philip does, where Jesus kind of evaporates in the tomb and descends to a higher form, but apparently can't bodily resurrect and just say what's up to everyone. But it seems like that doesn't actually solve the problem, it just adds a step. So if apologists are to be believed, then the disciples went from completely shattered, you know, the spell is broken, to being willing to die for their beliefs. So those must have been some pretty compelling experiences of the risen Jesus. So why couldn't he do that for anyone, if he could do it for those people? Doesn't actually explain why God isn't more apparent and obvious, and why he isn't reaching out in the same way that he reached out to the 500. So I don't see how it can solve that particular problem. So there are plenty of fundamentalist idiots who would probably not consider Philip a real Christian, since they don't seem to consider Dale Allison to be a real Christian. And their reasoning, I mean, this is just, I'm just trying to piece together things from Facebook comments and stuff, but they seem to think bodily resurrection is synonymous with real resurrection, and anything else is just phony. Even if you think it's physical, albeit, you know, oh, some form of energy, you know, Jesus ascended to a higher plane of existence. Well, they seem to think that if Jesus' body didn't just get up and start walking around, then it doesn't count. You're not a real Christian. I don't know. Like I said, there's some trickiness with the word physical, but it almost feels like they're conflating our ordinary sense of the word physical with being real. Like, so if it's not physical in the sense that they mean it, you know, like bodily, then it's not a real resurrection. That's very funny coming from non-physicalists. Oh, if it's just a spiritual visionary experience, that's not a real resurrection. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, are you a physicalist? I mean, to me, the question is, when the disciples saw Jesus or whatever, had experiences with Jesus, did Jesus see them too? And did Jesus have an experience of them as well? I don't really doubt that the disciples saw or felt Jesus. At least some of them did. You know, it might only be one or two, but still, a non-zero number of disciples, and probably Paul, had some kind of experience of Jesus. I don't doubt that. So the question is, did Jesus have an experience of them? They're looking at Jesus. Is Jesus looking back at them? Or when we say vision, do we mean it's like a hallucination or something? So the resurrection would not have to be bodily to say, yes, Jesus saw them too. It would not even have to be physical to say that. If we really are, you know, souls or spirits or something, and after our physical bodies die, we go on and live in heaven or hell, then I just don't see what the importance of the bodily resurrection is, or the physical resurrection. Why would Dale Allison not count as a real Christian? I really don't get it. So one thing that I don't think ever came up was the Trinity. Like, I don't remember reading that in Philip's Eon article. I don't remember hearing about it in the conversation with Cameron. And it's funny because I've been assured that belief in the Trinity is the defining, non-negotiable belief that Christians must have, or they are not real Christians. This often comes up when I'm defending Latter-day Saints, as I frequently find myself doing for some reason. They don't affirm, like, the traditional view of the Trinity, which is nice because the traditional view is incoherent. So when I argue that Mormons can be Christians. They can call themselves Christians. They have the right to do that if they want to. People like Inspiring Philosophy or random apologists on the internet will say, well, they don't affirm the right view of the Trinity, which is absolutely unambiguously disqualifying. Okay, so then why didn't it come up once in the hour, hour and a half conversation with Philip? I mean, you'd think that this absolutely non-negotiable piece of the puzzle would have come up, at least in passing, maybe once. Unless, you know, you're just opportunistically drawing a line in the sand because you want to exclude Mormons from the club. Surely that's not what's going on. Anyway, I don't really care if Mormons count as Christians when it comes down to it. I think that they are either Christians and just a weird sect of Christianity, or they're like a borderline case of Christianity. So not distinctly Christian, but not definitely not Christian either. They don't fall on one side of the Christian, not a Christian dividing line. They fall in the gray area between. So it's one of those two positions. They're either Christians or they're like a borderline case. The only position that's completely stupid is saying they are unambiguously not Christians. That's the only position that really can't be defended. If you try to make a list of, oh, these are the things one must accept to be a Christian, you can always find examples of people who are routinely considered to be Christians who did not believe those things. Like Isaac Newton, who's often claimed by Christians when they're trying to credit Christianity for science, despite Newton explicitly rejecting the Trinity. The concept Christian is a vague concept. You have to adopt something like population thinking to really understand it. If you try to understand Christian as analogous to precise geometrical concepts, then you're going to be deeply confused. Okay, here's a definition of Christianity that rules in everything that we want to consider Christianity and rules out everything that is not Christianity. You can't do that. But the thing is, you can't do that with most philosophically interesting concepts. I mean, that's pretty typical for the, conceptual world, as it were. It's less about conceptual analysis, you know, perfect definitions free from all counterexamples. It's more about family resemblance. There's sort of an analogy with biology here. You know, there was no first human. There was no first dog. There's just this continuous change. But there's no sharp line that was crossed where it's like, okay, this one was definitely not a human. And then the next generation, that was definitely human. No, it's just like this smooth continuum of gradual change. And then you can draw a circle around this population and say, this is a human. Oh, well, give me a perfect definition. You know, necessary and sufficient conditions, free from all counterexamples, including everything that's a human, excluding everything that's not a human. Nobody post-Darwin thinks you can do that. You have to adopt population thinking. You know, there's like a bell curve of human-like entities. It's not just like that with biological organisms. It's also like that with social groups, you know, with complicated, messy, vague concepts like Christianity. I mean, it's also true of things like chairs, okay? Games, heaps of sand. It betrays like a general lack of understanding of philosophy, I think, to actually think that you can come up with a list of like 10 things that actually is a perfect definition of Christianity, like as if there's some kind of worldview neutral way of defining a word that's like, okay, this is objectively what Christianity is. And anyone who falls outside this is not a Christian. Anyway, I bring that up not just because I have various beefs with Christian apologists, but because I want to, come a little bit to the defense of Philip Goff, because I think he's a Christian. I don't want to, I mean, I already thought he was a Christian, but now he's more unambiguously a Christian. You know, it is very weird to say, well, I'm an atheist, but I'm still a Christian. It's less weird if you're a Jew and you're an atheist, but something like secular Christianity is just not well established at this point. It might be, like maybe 100 years, 200 years from now, secular Christianity will be just as normal as secular Judaism, but at least at this point in history, it is, you are on the far end of the bell curve. So he's definitely moved closer to small o orthodoxy, but obviously he's still not really there. I mean, first of all, I think he said his credence in I can't remember if he said Christianity or God, but I just remember him throwing out the number like 30%. I don't want to attach too much significance to that because I was just listening to it at the gym. And it wasn't like taking notes or anything. Let's just say it was his credence in his, you know, finite theism. It's like 30%. Okay, so he thought that that was enough to take a leap of faith, you know, to trust in his like spiritual convictions, his will to believe, you know, to defend his right to believe. He's willing to take the leap of faith, even though he is mired in uncertainty, because ultimately he thinks we're all mired in uncertainty. And he says, well, this is worth taking a bet on. It's just odd to me to say that you think something is only like 30% likely and then believe it. I mean, that almost sounds impossible to me. This is like an ongoing debate, but can you have a high credence in something and not believe it? Can you have a low credence in something and believe it? Well, it actually seems pretty weird to say, I only have a 30% credence in such and such hypothesis, because an exactly equivalent statement would be, I think there's a 70% chance that this hypothesis is wrong. So I think it's more likely than not that this hypothesis is false. And yet you believe it. So the question is just whether you can separate credences and beliefs such that you can believe something that you think is probably false, or not believe something that you think is probably true. On the one hand, it sounds very odd to say, I am pretty sure that such and such is false, and I believe it. Because if you believe it, it almost is like a tacit affirmation of its truth, right? Can you believe something and not think it's true? That seems wrong. So you have to think it's true to believe it. So then what does it even mean to say, I think there's a 70% chance that it's false? I think it's probably false. It's more likely than not that it's false. And yet I think it's true. At the end of the day, your credence is 30%. So this is kind of getting at the debate over belief, credence, dualism. On the other hand, isn't it at least intelligible what Kierkegaard is saying when he says, oh, I believe because it's absurd to believe, you know, I take the leap of faith? Because what is that other than saying, even though I think it's probably wrong, I still take the leap of faith and believe it anyway? So as long as you think that's intelligible, then it can make sense to say, well, I only have a 30% credence in it, but I still believe it. You know, I don't have like settled views about belief, credence, dualism. But just at face value, it just seems off to say, well, I think this is probably false, but I still believe it's true. I don't know. That just sounds like you're being kind of schizophrenic about it almost. So a lot of Christians are not happy with Philip's conversion, quote unquote, because he's not even going to like omnitheism, you know, this perfect being, this being of unlimited power. He's like, no, God is finite. You know, there's all this evil in the world because he can't prevent the evil in the world. Or he never says he, it's always they or she when he's talking about God. whatever. What is wrong with calling God a he? It's just kind of like, even if God doesn't have genitalia or a gender or anything, like, what does it matter? Like, there's already an established custom. Like, I don't know, it just seems almost like pointlessly edgy. But like, you know, it, like woke edginess. Like, oh, I'm going to call God a girl. Why? Oh, because most people say he's a guy. Okay. It's just like transgressing some kind of cultural, social boundary for absolutely no reason. And in his recent article, he's calling God they. Well, maybe he is a Trinitarian after all. So anyway, Philip's liberal Christianity, or heretical Christianity, as Philip labels it, yeah, that's still Christianity. I think Philip is a Christian, but it's not surprising to me that Christians are being pretty brutal about it, like they're pretty underwhelmed, because they barely recognize progressive Christians as it is. You have people who are, you know, born in the faith, never deconverted, but they just deconstructed a little bit, you know, but didn't become atheists or agnostics, and now they're like more progressive Christians. A lot of people don't even consider them to be real Christians, you know? So the thing is, Philip was not a normal atheist, or at least like the atheist caricature that apologists want to tear down. So it's not as spectacular of a conversion, because what they really want is someone who's like a new atheist and a nihilist and a reductive materialist to go full on like William Lane Craig style Christianity. And they didn't get that. They got someone who was technically an atheist, but already kind of agreed with theists on a few things. You know, physicalism is wrong. We have free will, maybe even libertarian free will, rejecting the hypothesis of indifference. You know, a few issues here and there. And then he becomes this extremely progressive Christian who denies the virgin birth, who doesn't think Jesus was bodily resurrected, who doesn't think God is omnipotent. Okay, I can see why Christians are not happy with this, you know? And plus, Cameron just set it up in this insane way where he's like, a famous atheist has left his, the former, a famous atheist has, you know, converted to Christianity. It's like, dude, someone who already agreed with you about more than half of your worldview, someone who's been writing about how fine-tuning is this massive problem and psychophysical harmony is this massive problem and agrees with you about a whole number of other things, was never like a standard like caricature of an atheist. He goes from that to extremely progressive Christian. And Philip Goff was never famous for his atheism. Like, people weren't, they were like, he was an atheist? So, I mean, it's Cameron's fault, partly, for that Philip is getting the reaction he's getting, because he set it up in like two grandiose of terms. Former famous atheist, you know, converts to Christianity. And it's like, it's just pure clickbait. You know, Philip was already going to church. He was already a Christian fictionalist. He already rejected the hypothesis of indifference. 2 years ago, he appeared in a video on capturing Christianity entitled, "Are Atheists in Denial About Fine-Tuning?" So he was not the atheist caricature that, you know, apologists would want him to be. And he was not convinced by, like, standard apologetics either. Like, his, the place where he's ended up, this progressive heretical Christianity, is not only at odds with what most apologists would want, he also got there in a way that most apologists wouldn't want either. You know, like, I saw Braxton Hunter tweet something like, "Who says apologetics doesn't work?" I'm like, bro, do you think that Frank Turek-ass apologists are in any way responsible for how Philip got to where he is? I mean, listen to what he's telling you his Christianity involves. Okay, to be fair, they probably had something to do with stimulating thought in the first place, like bringing up an issue, defending a really stupid position, giving really bad arguments for it, and that might have prompted Philip to think about those issues, and then he kind of went his own direction with it. Beyond that, they played no role. This is one note on the word heretical, by the way, because he calls himself a heretical Christian, and it's like, okay, wait, heretical relative to what exactly? So I pulled up this article from Parable Magazine, which is put out by the Diocese of Manchester, I think. So this is an article about heresy. What is and isn't a heresy? Quote, "The Catholic Church has a very precise definition of heresy. It appears in the Code of Canon Law. Heresy is the obstinate denial or obstinate doubt after the reception of baptism of some truth which is to be believed by divine and Catholic faith. This definition has three key elements. Heresy is strictly limited to truths that are settled and indispensable teachings of the Catholic faith. For example, it is heretical to deny the bodily resurrection of Christ." Okay, so heretical is actually a perfect description there. "The existence of original sin, and the divinity of Christ. The Church has always taught these truths clearly and definitively." And he gives some examples of things that are not heretical, like insisting that the Eucharist must always be received by everyone under the forms of both bread and wine, that baptism must be done by full immersion, or that the Church should not grant annulments. So those things, they contradict established Church positions, but they don't rise to the level of heresy because they don't touch the core of the Catholic faith, according to this article. So is it technically heretical Christianity? Well, you know, plenty of non-Catholics believe things that, so I deny the bodily resurrection of Christ, but I'm obviously not a heretic. You have to actually be a Catholic who's been baptized, apparently, to be a heretic. Anyway, so that's what the Code of Canon Law says. That's what, you know, the Catholic Church has to say about heresy. But obviously the more, like, colloquial definition of heresy is just something that's non-conformist or infrequently believed. You're kind of like a dissident or something. But, you know, heresy is actually, I mean, it's considered to be a pretty serious offense. You know, it's not like, you know, different strokes for different folks. Especially, I mean, imagine if Philip was teaching at like a Christian college and he had to sign some kind of statement of belief or something. Like, he couldn't sign that statement in good faith. I want to return to defending Philip and his right to call himself a Christian. This is something Randall Rouser brought up in his review of the conversation. He said, look, if you just pull someone out of the pews randomly and start interrogating them about the kinds of things that Philip was talking about, you're not going to get like, oh, what do you think about God? What do you think about the nature of God? And then start asking them about important theological questions. You're going to get a jumbled mishmash of incoherent and often heretical views. But they're faithful Christians. You know, they're trying to live in accordance with the teachings of Jesus, you know, to the best of their knowledge and ability. They're acting out their faith. And look, they're just, this is just how people are. They don't go through their beliefs like analytic philosophers, methodically ironing everything out. Philip is actually trying to do that. Like, in good faith, he is trying to work out what he thinks about these things, and he's considering himself on the Christian path. You know, he's trying to live a Christian life, trying to be a follower of Jesus. He has every right to call himself a Christian. He is a Christian. If you want to add a modifier, like heretical Christian, that's totally fine, and he does that. He's trying to signal, yeah, I recognize that I'm on the far end of the bell curve, but still, I think I count as a Christian. One thing we haven't talked about yet is the atonement, and pretty much any theory of the atonement is going to seem weird to me, but penal substitution theory is clearly the worst, and Philip said as much. I don't think it's generally good to punish the innocent. I don't understand how it would be just. I mean, if God is going to kind of break ordinary rules and punish an innocent person, then why doesn't he break the ordinary rules and give everyone a pardon? You know, attributing guilt to someone who is innocent is just a mistake. So, like, I don't... It's just because... It's like, oh, well, I killed Jesus, but you have to understand, I falsely attributed guilt to him before I did it. Perfect. I mean, it doesn't make any sense that we would just put all of our sins onto a goat or a chicken or a human and then kill it and be like, well, that solves that. I mean, just at a base level, that is retarded. I mean, I'm sorry, but that it's just insane to me. I don't understand how people can think like that. Well, you see, I imputed my sins and guilt onto that chicken and then I killed it. What the fuck are you talking about? I don't understand how anyone can think that. But then to earnestly think that that solves the problem. Like, no, I imputed my guilt and sin onto this chicken. So what, the chicken was actually guilty? The chicken actually you were guilty, but the guilt was transferred onto that chicken, and now the chicken is guilty of all the things you did. Does that make any fucking sense? Okay, so either you can transfer your guilt to another person or animal. So, like, Jesus was guilty of all the things I've done, and then he was killed justly for that, I guess. Or Jesus remained innocent, in which case we just killed an innocent person for other people's crimes. How does that solve the problem? I mean, regardless, you're breaking ordinary rules. Like, you're punishing the innocent, or you're transferring guilt, which obviously you can't do that. Like, it doesn't make any sense. But I'm just saying, ordinary rules are being violated here, one way or another, in order to make penal substitution theory work. So then you can't help but ask, you know, why not just break the rules in a way that doesn't require torturing someone to death? Why not break the rules like, I give everyone a pardon? And people like Craig will apparently say, oh, well, this way, God could also demonstrate how much he doesn't like sin, like how much he hates sin. But of course, there are other ways you can imagine God demonstrating his hatred of sin that don't involve torturing an innocent person who is also his son and him to death. I mean, of course, it's a wonderful thing if you're gonna, you know, take a bullet for someone who you love, you know, like there's a bullet flying their way and you dive in front of it because you love them so much. Yeah, that's a beautiful thing, but that's not what happened in the crucifixion. This is how you get atheist memes like, you know, God sacrificed himself to himself to appease himself and stop himself from what he was going to do to us because of the rules that he made. Like, you get memes like that in part because of penal substitution theory. Oh, and also, it's so funny. One of the most common pushbacks I've seen from Christians when they hear that kind of meme is that it exposes an improper understanding of the Trinity, which, I mean, you could just easily rephrase it and the point would still stand. Just such a funny nitpicking objection. So returning for a moment to finite theism and how it's supposed to help with the problem of evil exactly. I know we're jumping all over the place, so sorry about that. So to put it one way, I saw someone on Twitter complaining that the idea that God is powerful enough to create the universe and fine-tune the laws of physics but not reduce the amount of child starvation by 3% per annum is just indefensibly stupid. So that's one way of putting the criticism. And Philip responded that there are different kinds of power. Like, you know, power is one of these words that can mean a lot of different things in different contexts. And, you know, like President Biden is more powerful than a sitting congressman, but in another sense, less powerful than a bodybuilder. So when you just look at ordinary sentences that contain the word power, you know, sometimes it doesn't even involve a person, like electrical power, nuclear power. Things can be powerful in many, many different senses, and they all seem like equally legitimate, sensible, coherent usages of the word power. And he's saying, well, it's not incoherent to say that this being is very powerful along one dimension, but not powerful along another dimension. So, like, this is the kind of being who can create a universe, but doesn't have the power to kind of fiddle with the universe after it's been created. That's at least a conceptual possibility. And I guess I agree it's a conceptual possibility, but at this point, it's, like, very, very vague, and I just want, like, a more robust account of this God's limitations. Like, okay, so there's a finite God who can create the universe and fine-tune laws of physics. He can adjust things on the fundamental level. He can, you know, create psychophysical laws that are harmonious. He can create laws of physics that permit life, but he can't stop an asteroid from killing the dinosaurs. So, like, on this more macroscopic level, he doesn't seem able to kind of fiddle with the universe, but he can mess around with, like, fundamental laws or something. Okay, that's not a being that we have any kind of direct experience with. That is something that is very far outside of our experience of the world. But I'm saying just, like, conceptually, yeah, that's, like, a possibility. But it's just, I would want, like, a more detailed account, because if you're going to reduce the problem of evil, you know, the evidential significance of suffering against your worldview, then you're going to have to limit God's power in a few particular ways. You know, okay, so God had to use evolution to bring about life. God couldn't have prevented, you know, the fawn dying in the forest fire. He can't stop child cancer. So, prima facie, that seems to rule out all miracles. It also seems to completely undermine petitionary prayer. So you might still pray to feel close to God or, you know, for some type of spiritual benefit or as some kind of, like, spiritual discipline or practice or something, but petitionary prayer is just out. So it has this side effect. Okay, yes, you've helped out with the problem of evil a little bit. Just at face value, it seems like you've diminished the power of the problem of evil against theism. Okay. You've also completely destroyed any miracle claims and undermined petitionary prayer as a practice. So I'd want to hear more about... I mean, I bet Philip would just bite those bullets, but, you know, it's just worth flagging that, like, hey, this comes as a package, you know? Of course, it doesn't rule out the possibility that strange things could happen that we would not understand and then erroneously label miraculous. Dale Allison talks a lot about parapsychology and, like, paranormal, metanormal things that are surprisingly well supported in our world. But along with Jimmy Akin and myself, you know, you've got a range of religious views there among the three of us. We often take the same attitude to some of these phenomena, which is that they're real, that they are not mediated by the ordinary physical natural processes that we know and understand at this point in history, but also that they are theologically maybe less significant than they're typically thought to be, or rather, they're not just crudely, bluntly done by God, quote-unquote. For instance, Dale Allison and Jimmy Akin both seem to believe that Joseph of Cupertino really did levitate. This, you know, Italian monk from a few hundred years ago really could just, like, levitate all the time. Not at will, it wasn't like a superpower he had. It just would happen to him sometimes when he was deep in a prayerful state or, like, in the midst of some type of religious ecstasy. He would float off the ground a bit. And, you know, I've said before that, like, the evidence for that is just way better than anything you would have expected because it's such an outlandish claim. You wouldn't expect, I guess, the testimony to be so abundant. Like, there are so many people who saw this under so many different circumstances, people who are Catholic and Lutheran, you know, people from different religious sects, people from different socioeconomic statuses, men and women, the light and dark, inside and outside, like I said, and just the sheer volume of people who saw this. It's just, like Dale Allison said, if it were anything that were not so starkly at odds with our background knowledge, it would just be, there's more evidence that Joseph of Cupertino levitated than Jesus was resurrected from the dead. I mean, it's not even comparable. When I say it's not theologically significant, that might be too broad. I think a lot of people have a very blockheaded view of this, where they think God just kind of picked up this Italian by his britches and just kind of floated him around for some reason, and then set him back down, and he's like, huh? Pretty cool, right? Bet you'd believe in Catholicism now, right? Like, that appears to be what I'm supposed to conclude. whereas Dale Allison, and I think Jimmy Akin, I know more about Allison's views, though, think that while he did levitate, they don't think God was just kind of picking up this semi-literate Italian and whatever. It's more like, okay, there's some kind of psi ability, you know, some kind of latent ability that some humans have, that he could just do that. It's just a weird thing that some people are able to do. It would only happen when he was in very unusual mental states. And, you know, unusual physical states are correlated here with unusual mental states. That makes sense on the surface. So when I say theologically insignificant, I don't want to divorce it from the context, which is, you know, he's a monk. This would only happen when he was in, like, a state of religious ecstasy. Like, one time he just saw a picture of the Virgin Mary and then kind of fluttered off the ground. And, you know, one time he really loved the image of lambs, you know, associated them with Jesus, obviously. And one time he was just, like, clutching a lamb, and he just floated off the ground and into a tree and then kind of snapped out of it and then was like, help! he just, like, floated into a tree and then got stuck in the tree, and they had to go get a ladder and get him down. I think of it more, like, if it did happen, which I'm totally open to that, if it did happen, it's more like, okay, there's a guy who lives this contemplative life who gets in these strange meditative mental states, and then these strange physical states correlate with it. And unsurprisingly, he's existing within a religious tradition while he's doing this. And yeah, like, it's all in this divine context and all in this Christian context. But to take this kind of blockheaded approach, like, God was playing with him like a kid plays with an action figure and just making him fly around. So that is not the only interpretation, and it's probably one of the least plausible interpretations I could think of. I would sooner believe that every last one of them was lying than I would believe that God was playing with a monk like an action figure. That is just not the best explanation. So anyway, why did I give that example? Well, because I think there can be, you know, paranormal seeming phenomena, like a monk demonstrating some parapsychological ability, like levitating. And then a lot of people say, oh my gosh, it's a miracle. And it's like, you can affirm that those events really took place and that they really are metanormal, but you don't have to say that, like, God did it. In fact, God did it is usually a bad explanation. Oh, I found my keys. God did it. That's a bad explanation. Whereas, you know, someone like me, or even Christians, you know, like, oftentimes if you listen to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, or if you read Dale Allison's book, Encountering Mystery, what you'll find is that they are often open to all these strange things that happen, but the religious significance of them, if there is any, is usually indirect. Philip could affirm miracles in that sense, where there are things that most naturalists would reject, that most Christians would accept as the activity of God. And you could accept that these things really happen, but think that most Christians are misinterpreting them. So there's some wiggle room there with miracles. I guess I just wanted to kind of stake that out a bit. Look, I have a lot of respect for Philip Goff as a philosopher. I suppose the parting thought I'll leave you with is that I detect in Philip, and I'm sure he'd be upfront about this, that, you know, the will to believe, like a desire to believe. You know, he wants this to be true, which I relate to that. Like, there are many days out of the week when I want Christianity to be true, or at least some kind of theism to be true. Because I think theism is plausibly incompatible with gratuitous suffering, or it at least means that the universe is not indifferent, and that justice is more likely to win out in the end, that there will be a happy ending to the universe instead of just completely meaningless, sad one. So, like, theism, I think, is probably the best antidote to pessimism, and I'm becoming increasingly pessimistic. So I can understand wanting theism to be true, and I can even understand wanting Christianity to be true, because I think Christianity plausibly entails something like universalism. And I think Philip is either a universalist or an annihilationist, based on what I've seen him say on Twitter. But anyway, I'm just saying, it seems like Philip, you know, the image that keeps coming into my head is like a rock rolling down a hill, and it's like it wants to go down that hill. You know, like that's its tendency, like that's where it is going to go unless it's stopped. It's going to stay in motion until something else acts on it. So, you know, Philip is rolling down this hill towards Christianity, and then there are these obstacles that are in the way. And it's like, if you can just remove those obstacles, then he's going to keep rolling down the hill. But the bias is all in favor of wanting Christianity to be true. I'm not even saying that as like some kind of harsh condemnation or something. Like, I think he would be willing to defend his kind of, you know, bias or tendency, you know, or like gravitational pull towards Christianity. Like, I think he'd be willing to defend that, because he was sort of like sketching out some potential defenses for like going towards Christianity specifically instead of Islam or something like that. And even going towards Christianity despite thinking it's probably false in terms of just bare credence. Anyway. So I think that he wants it to be true on some level, and I get that because I also want it to be true on some level. But it feels like that's what's happening. It feels like he's saying, if I can make this work, then I'm going to make it work. If I can come up with some way that this can possibly fit together, then I'm going to take that option. You know, so when he's making his case for panpsychism, it's often broken up into two phases. Phase one is just establishing the coherence of the view. Like, here's what the view is. Here's how it's possible that panpsychism is true. And then phase two is motivating the view. Here are some reasons to think this coherent possibility is more likely to be true than not. It feels like the motivational part was somewhat absent from the conversion story. It was more just like, here's how I could technically affirm the resurrection. Like, here's how I could technically count as a Christian without believing all these standard doctrines. Oh yeah, I think that Jesus was wrong about divorce. I think Paul was wrong about homosexuality. I don't think any of the miracles happened. I don't think the virgin birth happened. Which, by the way, what does that mean? Does that mean that Mary was just like, you know, sleeping with somebody else? That's always what I've assumed. You know, like, I don't know the exact ages, but it sounds like Mary was like a teenage girl maybe, and Joseph was a little older. And it's like, do you think maybe this teenage girl had, oh, I don't know, a boyfriend, maybe from the same village or a neighboring village, like someone her own age who she actually liked? Do you think that maybe maybe she ended up pregnant because of that situation and not her adult husband, who some Catholics argue was previously married? That's a real head scratcher. No, it was probably literally a virgin birth. As Randall Rouser pointed out in his video, though, denial of the virgin birth is not unprecedented in Protestant history. Like, two of the leading Protestant theologians of the 20th century apparently rejected it. Can't remember their name because I'd never heard of them, but I guess it exists. You know, and I say that he kind of wants this to be true, and based on the Twitter replies I've seen, he's like, no, I'm just following where the arguments lead. Okay, so the arguments led you to think that Jesus was vaporized in the tomb? I mean, you yourself are saying you can't get higher than like a 30% credence in some of this stuff, and then you have to take a leap of faith. How is that following where the arguments lead, if you're taking a leap of faith? So anyway, I feel that Philip really wants this to be true, and it's just this, can I make it work? Oh, I can make it coherent. Okay, I'm accepting it now. And I feel like if you put that kind of energy into anything, you could make it work. I mean, if all you have to do is make it coherent, and then you're going to accept it, well, you could do that with anything. You could do that with Hinduism or Mormonism or really any religious tradition. You could do it with atheism. You could do it with naturalism. You could say, oh, all I have to do is come up with a story that is at least coherent, and then I'm going to take the leap of faith, you know, to fill in the gaps there. Yeah, you could do that with anything. So you have to sort of already be rolling down the hill. Like, you have to have a tendency that's already pushing you in that direction anyway in order for that to actually happen. Because I can almost accept most of the things that he says. Like, hey, this is a possibility. Maybe this is what the resurrection was like. And I can say, yeah, I suppose that is a conceptual possibility. That is an option that Christians could take if they so chose. Why the fuck would I think that's true? Why would I think that God or that Jesus evaporated in the tomb and then like transformed into pure energy and then caused all the disciples to like sense his presence and feel him, but not like physically engage with him? Why would I think that that's true? Like, I can recognize that that's a coherent sentence. You know, that's a state of affairs that is not like contradictory or something. But why would I think it's true, you know? I mean, again, you could do this with Mormonism. You could do this with Hinduism. You could do this with any story about reality, like theistic or non-theistic. You have to already have this bias towards wanting Christianity to work in order for this to matter, is what I'm saying. And just as a side note, this is something Cameron said, where he goes, as Philip was talking about finite theism, Cameron goes, this is why I just have no respect left for atheism, because this is an option. You know, never mind that it implodes anything else that I've ever said about miracles or petitionary prayer. Even if I thought the problem of evil was like really great evidence against theism, well, then I can just be a finite theist. So why would I ever be an atheist? You know, it's like this is the safety net, finite theism. You realize that you could just as easily say that about different forms of naturalism, where it's like, oh, well, I thought naturalism was all about nihilism and reductive physicalism and denying that we have free will. But then I realize that you can, you know, believe in libertarian free will and be a non-physicalist, you know, be a moral realist, even as a naturalist. So now I just have no respect at all for theism. Why would you ever be a theist? Because you have this safety net of like, you know, spookier forms of naturalism or more liberal forms of naturalism. Why would you ever be a theist? So I just have no more respect for theism. So he doesn't treat alternate forms of naturalism like that, but he does treat alternate forms of theism like that. So I think I'm going to leave it there for now. You should check out what Nathan Ormond from Digital Gnosis said about this whole affair. Amos Wallen on his Substack wrote about it. Randall Rouser posted about it on his YouTube channel. Highly recommend all three. If you happen to be in England, in the Durham area, I'll be speaking at a conference on consciousness there in early November. So you should come and hang out if you're in the area. So until then, thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I will see you next time.